I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Among the bills being tussled over in Tallahassee are sanctuary cities, arming teachers, and restoring voting rights to felons who've served their sentences. With just under half of the session left, how will this legislature shape the laws of Florida? Well, Frank Torres is a Republican political analyst. Thank you so much for coming back, Frank.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Democratic political analyst Dick Batchelor, former state lawmaker. Thank you as well.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the budget. This is the one thing that has to get done out of this legislative session. There is a difference, is there not, Frank, between the budgets coming out of the House and the Senate?
Yeah, there is. And traditionally, the House has always been a little bit more conservative on the budget side. And this is there's no difference this year. The interesting thing to watch here is for our listeners is to see how the House and the Senate get along with the budget. In past years, there have been a peaceful approach to resolving the budget difference, or sometimes there have been not so peaceful results in the budget difference. And that's the one thing the legislature has to do. And just seeing the chemistry, especially with a new governor and a lot of new lawmakers in the legislature, is really interesting to see how it works out.
Right. In fact, there's been special sessions in the past because they haven't been able to come to an agreement.
Right. Right on the cusp of a government shutdown, and you know, it's very, very interesting to see what people prioritize in their budgets.
Dick Batchelor, what are the chances of a special session this year, do you think?
I think they get the budget resolved, but to follow up on what Frank said, that it would be interesting to see what the Speaker of the House and the Senate President are holding out for. It might be totally unrelated to the budget, some legislation. In the Senate budget, Senator Galvano wants to build three new, basically, interstate systems in the state of Florida. There was not a House sponsor in the budget, but, you know, that goes to conference now, and the House
passes.
Where
on earth did that come from?
I think Senator Galvano, the west coast of Florida, they just would like to have some more new roads, infrastructure, economic development, and whatever mask you want to put on it. But I think getting back to the budget in the House and Senate, if you look at the Senate budget, it has substantially more money per the governor's request than the House does, and not only in education, but affordable housing. Mm-hmm. Remember, the governor did not sweep the Sadowski funds, left over $400 million in there. In the Senate, they held that position. In the House, they're taking $135 million, but they're going to take that money and divert it to the Panhandle, where the hurricane had so much impact. So that was one. The education one is going to be a very big one. They're about $400 million apart on education. The governor put about $1 billion new money into the budget, for K-12 education, and the House is not there yet. But it would be interesting to see how they hold out, how long they hold out, and what's the issue, if it's a budget related or is it just something totally unrelated dealing with, you know, abortion or marijuana or whatever. We'll just have to see.
Speaking of Governor DeSantis, he continues with his major announcements. Frank Torres, is this kind of low-hanging fruit for the governor, some of the things he's doing?
You know, it is. And the reason why the governor's approval ratings are doing so well is because he's going after this low-hanging fruit. And you're not going to find any voters that don't want to crack down on the opioid crisis, that don't want to take drugs off the street and put drug dealers in jail. These are easy victories for the governor. And I believe, Dick, you are particularly involved or had some familiarity with that as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm on the Orange County, the Central Florida Opioid Commission, and I was invited to be at the press conference where the governor announced not only the $28 million new dollars, federal dollars, for the fight that crisis too, and that goes with another $75 million that had drawn down for the federal government. And then he appointed the attorney general to be the chair of the statewide task force on opioids, the opioid abuse, and the crisis there. So, yeah, I agree with Frank. It is low-hanging fruit because, no, I mean, everybody wants to do something about the opioid crisis. There are about 70 people a week die in the state of Florida from an overdose. So we want to do something. So it's not a controversial issue. Low-hanging fruit, yes.
Is this kind of like a drug czar, and would they be more on the side of enforcement, or are we taking a softer approach from maybe approaches in the past?
Well, actually, the governor's going to reopen the drug czar office, and he also has a surgeon general who might not, he won't get be confirmed this session. Then the attorney general. So you've got the drug czar, the surgeon general's office, and then the attorney general chairing a statewide task force on opioid abuse. So he's really made this a top issue.
Talking about some of the other issues, and one of the things one of the bills that is generating quite a bit of controversy is the notion of arming teachers. What's happening with this, Dick Batchelor?
I mean, it's still moving ahead, but that's one of those issues that might move ahead but might not make it in the end because it's so, so controversial. But I don't know. I mean, I just think it's a really a bad idea, and a lot of people do too. But the Republicans control the you know, the Senate 23-17 margin in the House. It's a more substantial margin. Republicans control that House, some would say, with an iron fist. So it could still pass. Mm-hmm. Could still pass.
Who's behind it?
Well, that's a very good question. A lot of people will tell you, Marion Hammer, the longtime NRA lobbyist up there in Tallahassee, they would tell you that she strikes fear in the hearts of a lot of lawmakers and red districts. Other people will tell you that they are lawmakers that indeed philosophically believe that it's the best way to go. But, you know, it is a component of the ongoing gun debate mm-hmm. that takes place in Tallahassee every year, that's taking, especially with the recent tragedies, and it's going to continue to move forward in the future. I think one deciding factor will be time. Mm-hmm. When we get past to this point in the legislature, people start looking at their calendars and they start looking at legislature and they start to pick which battles are really worthwhile and if they're willing to sacrifice other bills that are currently being considered for the sake of a piece of legislation that might not be that popular.
Mm-hmm. It's not the only controversial bill. There's also the Sanctuary City bill. Mm-hmm. Some might say that the idea of sanctuary cities in Florida is a bit of a red herring. Some of the groups giving Joe Gruters, he's the Florida Republican Party chair and the Sarasota senator who wrote the bill, some of those groups have been advising Gruters on it, have been labeled hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Of course, there's some pushback against that label by Gruters and those groups themselves, but nonetheless, these are kind of hardline ideas. And Frank, I just wonder what's going to happen with this particular piece of legislation.
You know, for a bill being sponsored by the RPOF chair, it's an awfully un-Republican bill. One thing you have to remember is that this creates redundancies both at the state and local levels. I don't want my state lawmakers telling me how my communities are enforced. I want county sheriffs. I mm-hmm. want police chiefs telling me how my communities are enforced.
So you're saying the overreach makes it less of a kind of Republican
you're adding an extra involvement by the government. I don't see how tough that is. And one thing to remember about Joe Gruters is he's Donald Trump's Florida campaign chair. He was last time, mm-hmm. and he has a close relationship with the governor. And this was also a campaign promise by Ron DeSantis. So if it passes, it's probably going to get signed. But it's something for the Trump base in Florida, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, nothing more.
Mm. Right. So you're saying it may not be necessarily enforced, or it might be difficult to enforce.
I'm saying it's going to be difficult to enforce, and initiatives like this have come up before. And at every time, you'll get local lawmakers, sheriffs, county chiefs, mayors, asking you how they're going to, you know, fight an opioid crisis or crack down on violent crime when they have extra responsibilities that should be taken care of by the federal levels and should be more carefully thought out when. During the solutions process.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, there is some nuance, right, to the immigration debate, which gets lost a little bit in some of these bills. In the Orlando Sentinel, Scott Maxwell was writing about the difference between the rhetoric and reality and talking about the idea of tightening up on enforcement of E-Verify, or at least enforcing mm-hmm. E-Verify. Many businesses rely on undocumented labor to keep their businesses running so that they don't go for it. What are your thoughts there? Is there any kind of movement on some of those other aspects of immigration that aren't talked about as much, perhaps?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, E-Verify, because the fact, as the governor said, and every governor prior to him has said, and particularly Scott, that we're going to do E-Verify, which is a database where you can verify whether or not somebody's a legal or illegal immigrant. But they don't want it. In fact, out in Texas, they just had the biggest bust ever. They busted 258 employees at this one plant, which is basically an entire employee base at the plant, and for undocumented aliens, you know, working there. It's a very difficult issue, but E-Verify, if you want to do anything about legal versus illegal immigration, E-Verify works. And by the way, on the sanctuary cities, the problem one is kind of a solution in search of a problem. There aren't any mm-hmm. sanctuary cities in the state of Florida. But it always surprises me, and we can talk about it some later, is how now the Republicans love local government until they don't. And all that the legislature are trying to pass to impose restrictions upon local government be able to govern. So anyway, but on E-Verify, if you want to do something about it, that's the thing you want to do.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to political commentators Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres about the legislative session around about the midpoint of the session so far. Let's come back to the notion of arming teachers and kind of as a part of what got this whole process going, of course, the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School last year, and in the aftermath of that, Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel suspended and he's now appealing that decision. There's kind of a public battle between the sheriff and the governor. What kind of test of this is of gubernatorial power, Dick Batchelor?
Yeah, it challenges it, I think, because the sheriff's elected. And I think he's elected in Broward County.
Mm-hmm.
So let the people decide. I mean, there was the response to the Parkland shooting was not good. The officers on the ground at that time, a couple of them had been dismissed because they didn't respond by going into the building. It was one of the issues that there wasn't just what neither transpired did not. But the Parkland shooting is so emotionally invested in this trauma that it really drives a lot of this debate. And so if you can attach the sheriff's behavior and accuse him of not being responsible enough, you can remove him, of course. Is it political? Maybe. He can challenge it legally? Maybe. But anything surrounding Parkland, though, is toxic because mm-hmm. of so many lives lost there.
Frank Torres, what do you make of this?
Well, there had to be responsibility taken by authorities. This investigation found that that Sheriff Israel didn't react to this in the best possible way he could, and the governor acted. And if you'll recall, on Inauguration Day, while he didn't directly call out Israel, he mentioned that people that weren't responsible or effective in their positions would be removed. And less than 48 hours later, he was gone. Mm-hmm. And now, so far, it looks like the courts are reinforcing the governor, saying he was acting appropriately when he made the decision. Dick's right. This guy gets to run for re-election get elected again. And ultimately the people will decide. But, mm-hmm. you know, so far everything is leaning towards the notion that the governor was acted appropriately when he decided to get rid of him.
I wonder, though, Scott Israel may be unpopular because of what happened at Parkland, but is this really a road that people want to see the state go down, where an elected official, may be removed because of decisions they take?
I think that if it wasn't done through the channels it was being done, if there wasn't that investigation, if it was more of a knee-jerk reaction and they just wanted, somebody to politically take the fall, it might be like that. But all the sources that you've seen coming out of Parkland, while it is very emotional an issue that adds to an issue that already needs to continue to be addressed, everything leaned towards the evidence that Israel didn't do what he should have or as much as he could have to draw down that tragedy. And that's what we're saying right now.
Let's talk a little more about Amendment 4, reinstating the right to vote for felons who serve their time. Democrats have said efforts by the legislature to put some rules around how that rolls out, stipulating fees and fines have to be paid too before the right to vote comes back to the felon who's served their time, is tantamount to a poll tax. Of course, that's pretty charged language, and Republicans have hit back and said, no way is it a poll tax. Dick Batchelor, what do you say about that?
Well, the good news is there's a court record of when they argued this amendment before it went on the ballot before the Florida Supreme Court. John Mills, a former speaker, and a friend who's a former, actually he's a dean emeritus of the Law School, University of Florida, basically told the judge, yes, it includes them paying these penalties. So mm-hmm. now that's established court record, right? So it's hard to argue that it doesn't include that. So I think there was always anticipation that, like, court fees and things like that would be paid, and court penalties would be paid, and restitution would be paid. So they – but need to get – I'm confident they'll get it done because there is a constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And supervisory elections are registering formerly convicted felons, so they need to resolve this issue. I feel it will be done. There's some kind of hyperbole on both sides of the issue, but I think it will get resolved, and I think it will. The amendment will go into effect.
How do you see this shaking out, Frank Torres?
Part of the marketing, and I say marketing because there was advertising, and Amendment 4 did get an amount of bipartisan support.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But the message was that these residents had repaid their debt to society. Mm-hmm. And then here you have a literal debt that needs to be repaid, and there's controversy over it. I think ultimately it will get sorted out. The state government does need to – they're not looking too sharp with enacting these amendments. I mean, we've seen problems with medical marijuana amendment being enacted, mm-hmm. The water amendment, Amendment 1 from a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They might want to streamline that process to enact the will of the voters more effectively. But this time, I think they need to sort these this information, these details out, and then move forward from there.
This plus trying to put some restrictions around what you can actually get on as a citizen-led initiative, you know, increasing the number of signatures you need, having some restriction around who can actually go out and collect those signatures.
Right.
Is this Republicans consolidating power, or is there just something else going on?
One thing, whenever I hear constitutional amendment, I think one of the most powerful actions you can make in state government, amending the Constitution, and there have been some criticisms, a lot from Republicans, is that it's something that you shouldn't go for right away, that you should try to make these things happen through the legislature, through legislative channels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that lawmakers need to take inventory of how they're taking consideration or input in from citizens before they move forward with making an amendment to the Constitution even more difficult. So if residents are doing this because they feel like their voices aren't being heard and they need to take a more citizen-active approach, and if lawmakers feel differently, then they need to re-examine that process and consider how they can communicate with constituents better to make sure they're enacting the policy so they don't have to go to the process.
Keep in mind, John Morgan only tried twice, but got it done by spending $10 million each time on medical marijuana. But now he's got the petition for a minimum hourly raise, graduated into $15 an hour over 4 years, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'll get votes for it, but obviously, again, the legislature is restricting or wanting to restrict the ability. And rather than getting 60% of the vote, it used to be 50, remember, plus mm-hmm. one, and now it's 60. Now they want to take it at 66 and two-thirds, so making it very difficult to amend the Constitution. Or, better put, petition your government directly.
One final question, not politics-related, but ever since I started working at WMFE, this was way back in 2012, the Magic have never, ever made it to a playoffs, and now finally they're back in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I wonder if you watched that game, Frank Torres?
I did, and I've been following the Magic, and let me tell you, whenever the Orlando Magic does well, it's good for the community, just like when UCF, and recently UCF basketball, it mm-hmm. does, it really galvanizes the community, and there was some concern that the road back to the playoffs might have taken a couple more years, but Steve Clifford has done a great job, and Nikola Vucevic is an all-star for them, that seems to be getting a double-double every night. There seems to be some hope. We'll see if they can do some damage.
I happened to be at the Pistons game the other night, and maybe it was my cheering that put them across the top. But when they follow up with 149 points scored in another game, it's very, very exciting. Having been here, obviously, since the Magic started here in the old days of Shaq and Hardaway and all, it's really great to see them in the playoffs.
Well, Dick Batchelor, Democratic political analyst, former state lawmaker, and he's now with the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Frank Torres, Republican political analyst. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Intersection, we revisit a conversation with Josh Murdoch about how technology is changing the way teachers teach and students learn. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Whether it's social media or augmented reality, technology plays a big role in the classroom of today. Teachers are jumping on Twitter to help research classroom projects, and students are donning VR headsets to immerse themselves in historical sites or take part in virtual classes. From the Education Desk, a look at the brave new world of EdTech. Well, Josh Murdoch is an associate faculty and a manager of instructional design at Valencia College. Thank you so much for joining us, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For those who maybe aren't familiar with the term, what is EdTech?
So EdTech is basically educational technology. So it's really just a short term a lot of educators use or people in education use to talk about all the technology and things that go into really education, and what's going on with EdTech is all about, you know, those kind of terms, things from apps to technology used in the classroom, all those kind of pieces and parts.
Mm-hmm. There must have been an explosion in this stuff in the last 5 years or so, right? How do you stay abreast of all of it?
It's really hard because a lot of these are startups. We know startups, things happen, and sometimes they're great and they go away, or they're bought out or something, you know, or they continue on and they cost more money, things like that. So it's really hard to kind of keep abreast of everything that's going on. But a lot of it, social media is a great way to do that. Talking with other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's things like EdCamp out there that happen that it's like a unconference thing that happens around different places all over the world, and it's a way to learn from each other. So those are some of the best ways, is talk to other teachers. What are they doing? What are they trying? And also pay attention to social media, Twitter, blogs, things like that. What are people using? What are people talking about?
Now, I know certain groups of professionals use Twitter more than others. Like, for example, people in the journalism and media field are rely on Twitter quite heavily. What about teachers? Do they use it a lot as well?
I think it's a mixture. I think some people just don't get it. And kind of like before you start using Twitter, you really don't get it. I think a lot of people see that. So there's a mixture of people. You're seeing a bigger push for it in the school system. So even in the K-12 system here, Orange County Public Schools, you're seeing them use it more and throughout the schools and different pieces and parts to share information and get things out there. So it's a great way. And they're really encouraging teachers to utilize it too and figure out how they can use it. I do that actually in the classroom too. I teach a social networking for job search course. And I talk about, you know, how you can utilize that to find jobs and connect with people and resources and all these different parts. So, you know, I see more and more people still using it. I think people get that it's used in a different way than your personal social network. So your Facebook or your LinkedIn, where you might already know these people and connected with them. These are people you probably don't know, or you might have met sometime or at a conference. You're using the hashtag for that conference and connecting with them as well.
How much of what you teach your students delves into kind of the boundaries that people need to be aware of around social media? Like, say, using Twitter for job seeking, for example, you're going to present a slightly different face than if you're just using it to kind of make social links with people. How do you sort of make sure people know how to navigate all that? Because that's quite complex.
Yeah, I think the best way is actually getting them to experience it and try something out. So I also teach a course for faculty called Teaching and Learning with Social Media. I teach them how to utilize it in their classroom a little bit. And we just have them delve into it a little bit. Hey, let's practice using a hashtag that you might use in a course, or trying to find some people to follow and things like that. So as you get into it, it helps them learn a little more about it, and they might love it and keep using it, or some just say it's not for me. So that can happen too as well. So it's really just diving into those different pieces and getting hands-on with it. If you don't use it, you don't know how to use it.
Right, but there are some pitfalls, right? I mean, you sometimes see that when corporations say they want to use a hashtag, sometimes that hashtag can get co-opted by somebody who wants to use it for something completely different, right? Is there a risk of that happening if you're want to use it for research? Can that happen too?
Oh, that totally can happen. So definitely before you use a hashtag, check who's using it or has used it in the past. So that's one thing. Also, sometimes people make it just really unique to their course if they're using it inside a course or in a specific way. And other people have really encouraged people using hashtags. You know, how can you encourage someone to, you know, be a great teacher or be involved or thank a teacher? You know, those kind of things, like, you think about is like, how can you connect with that? But also, how can you teach people the right way to use social media? Think about the pitfalls of using social media too, like how that can reference, you know, you don't, of course, want to say anything out there that might be bad towards your employer, or bad towards, you know, the students that you teach and things like that. Those are things to think about. So anything you wouldn't want to put out there anyways, make sure you don't put it out there.
So I'm wondering what sort of trends you're seeing in education technology this year, Josh, that maybe other folks haven't caught on to yet.
Yeah, I think we're seeing, you know, a huge trend in AR or augmented reality, or also mixed reality, some people call it. Those kind of things are starting to pop up. You're going to start seeing that more and more. Things like Magic Leap that's coming out this year.
What is that?
So it's a whole new company that's kind of been a mystery company of what they're doing, but they're using that mixed reality sense of goggles that you're wearing, and you can see different things that are overlaid in real life. So you're going to start seeing some of that being developed and come out there. Microsoft already has HoloLens, which is kind of the similar aspect of that. You're going to also see a lot more probably going towards the trend of, you know, using your phone for AR too.
Right.
You've already seen that, you know, come popular with like Pokemon Go, right? That kind of popped it up and got people. But there's a lot you can do with that as well.
Mm-hmm. And you can just slide your phone into like a cardboard set of goggles sometimes, right, too?
Yeah, so that Google Cardboard made it really affordable and easy to use and something where you can use your device you already have. But then things that are coming out where you're doing not just augmented reality, but virtual reality. So mm-hmm. you're diving into doing virtual field trips using Google Expeditions or something like that. You're also looking at virtual classroom spaces. So there's a local company called Doghead Simulations that works out of Full Sail, and they're diving into really that virtual meeting space, virtual classroom lecture space, where you're going to be wearing an Oculus or a Rift or Oculus Go now that has the potential to be in that meeting or in that classroom. And they can bring up 3D objects and you can move around and see what's going on and see what's happening.
That would be something you could use in an online class, right? But how is it going to help sort of bringing up a virtual lecture theater? Like, how is that any better than just, you know, logging into the class from your living room or something?
I think one thing is you're seeing a lot more people be connected. You think of gameplay now, right? Mm-hmm. When you play games, you always now have a headset on. You're talking with the other people you're playing with. You're going through that. I think that same aspect, but also you're able to move around and go to different places. You're able to manipulate an object maybe on your own instead of just the teacher manipulating something. So that virtual reality space, that's going to be totally different. That's going to help kind of dive into maybe that virtual field trip. You get to take it. The teacher doesn't have to show you where to go. You're mm-hmm. going to be able to explore a little more on your own.
Is this stuff happening already, or is this kind of a little ways into the future?
You see some of it already happening, especially as you talked about the Google Cardboard or Google Expeditions. They've been all over the country to schools, you know, showcasing that, giving that to students to try and use. Plus, I mean, you can go pick up a pair for $5, right? As long mm-hmm. as you have a phone or something. A lot of the expeditions or things, virtual trips that you can go visit Mars or go check out our moon or things like that, that you can just for free, you mm-hmm. know, things that are out there that are available.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there seems like there's a bit of a interplay or kind of porousness between, say, the entertainment world, whether it's theme parks that are using this kind of thing or even, you know, online gaming and education. How does that all work? How does that fit together?
So it's funny. I think a lot of people used the term in the past, edutainment. Mm-hmm. So how do you entertain someone, educate them, and teach them about something? But I think a lot of times technology is used in other places and then brought into education. So you're going to see corporate take on something. They have money to spend. It's a lot harder for a school to invest in something first time, really expensive, one-time kind of thing, mm-hmm. Compared to a larger corporation. They can invest in something, try it out, and build it. Well, guess what? It gets cheaper then. Mm-hmm. As more people become, you know, used to using it or having that technology available, or they can produce more headsets or whatever they're going to do. But you also are seeing a lot of more companies that are educational companies that are just focused on that. Or maybe it's a corporate company that's looking out and connecting with corporates, but then they give a discount for educators or a freebie for educators or things like that too.
Mm-hmm. Josh Murdoch, do you think technology like augmented reality, like virtual reality, is that just changing fundamentally the way people learn?
I think so. I think you're fundamentally going to change the way people are able to experience things. You know, you don't have to be in a certain place to experience something as much. You know, who knows? It could be a concert mm-hmm. you're experiencing live. It might be hard to take your 1,000 students to a concert, but imagine if they could experience that concert right there or that play or something like that. Also, you know, you can't go to Egypt. You probably can't take all your students to Egypt, right? Hey, mm-hmm. let's go through the pyramids. Let's walk through them, experience these. So you're going to see a lot more of those kind of experiences that you never could have before. But also imagine being able to take a body and a cadaver that's virtual and be able to manipulate it and move it around and look through the body and check it out and all mm-hmm. these kind of different pieces and parts that you're seeing already people using at like UCF Medical School.
Or even like Ant-Man, sort of shrink yourself and then do a walkthrough of something.
Yep, and something you couldn't do, you know, right now as reality, but you could do as virtual.
Mm-hmm. Are there some apps that you can't do without, Josh Murdoch?
There's a lot of apps that I can't do without, but I definitely love, of course, Dropbox or Google Drive, both of those. You know, I can't do without having those files available anywhere I go and keeping things backed up. I think those are both definitely ones that I love. I am a camera guy, too, so Snapseed is my favorite kind of camera editor that I have on my phone and be able to use. It's free. It's built by through Google and things like that. But you can use an iPhone or anything. Also, when you start looking at one of the favorite ones I have for the talk about with teachers and things is also Kahoot. Have you ever played Kahoot game?
I haven't, no.
So Kahoot is kind of fun with teachers. They can do almost like live quizzing and live like activities, and students can compete who can answer fastest and things like that on phones. Another one that's great is called Quizlet. So virtual flashcards. So having these flashcards on your phone or whatever, the great thing about it is you can add photos to them, but also sounds. So imagine trying to learn a foreign language and having that repeated back to you or science terms or something complicated, or just having that idea of having the auditory with the visual and those kind of pieces.
Not education related, but do you play Fortnite?
So I do. My son plays Fortnite. I have an 11-year-old, so of course every 11-year-old, I think, plays Fortnite, at least it seems like. But I play with my son a lot of times and things like that, and definitely, you know, have fun. And that's the environment. I'm seeing him play with people that are other kids around the country and things like that, and working together as a team. And it's funny to see, you know, those kind of things. You think there's good parts and bad parts about, you know, you can be addicted to a video game and keep playing and hard to get off, and you forget time. Forget about time kind of goes away. But also, it's like teamwork, and how do we work together, and how do we share or share resources and things like that? Or how do we come up with a strategy on what we want to do?
So I guess there's an app you can match up with that to make sure you don't spend too much time playing Fortnite or some other online game.
Yeah, so there's quite a few different like Zen apps that can grow a tree. So you put down your phone and it tries to grow a tree by the time you're done.
Well, Josh Murdoch, Associate Faculty at Valencia College, also Manager of Instructional Design, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last July. Up next, how the actor who played Uhura in the original Star Trek series helped launch a generation of NASA astronauts. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Florida Film Festival starts this weekend. Opening night features the documentary Women in Motion. It's the story of actor Nichelle Nichols and her quest to recruit women and minorities to NASA's space shuttle program. Director Todd Thompson joins me in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Star Trek fans will know the name Nichelle Nichols. For those who aren't Trekkies, though, just explain who she is and why she started this recruitment drive for astronauts for the shuttle program.
Well, Nichelle Nichols played the character of Lieutenant Uhura on the original series. She actually, when she first got to Hollywood, she was in a she had her first appearance on TV in a show called The Lieutenant, which was also a Gene Roddenberry show, a show that he had created and wrote. And so that's where they met. And he always told her, you know, I'm working on something. If it comes together, I got a part in it for you. And she waited patiently, and sure enough, she got a call one day from her agent and said, get back to she was in London at the time doing a play, and her agent called and said, you know, get back to the States, where they're casting for Star Trek. And she didn't even know the name of the show at the time, so she went in, and the rest is history. So she was one of the first African-American females on television in a leadership role, which was very significant at the time, and one thing led to another, and a lot of milestones were created on that show, obviously. One of them being the first interracial kiss, as you know, and whatnot. So, yeah, that's how she got her start.
And at a certain point, she's like, I want to try and pay this forward a little bit and make sure that there are more women and minorities getting involved in the space program.
Sort of, yeah. It actually happened a little differently than that. Star Trek lasted about 3 seasons and got canceled. That's when I guess the network realized, you know, what an incredible fan base they had. They got millions and millions of letters sent to the studio complaining that it got canceled. But what was birthed out of that was the sci-fi convention, and so they started having Star Trek conventions, and little by little, you know, thousands and thousands of people started showing up. And in the mid-70s, NASA started going to those conventions. And a gentleman in particular, Jesko von Puttkamer, was there. He was their director of science. And he happened to be, you know, on the panel at one of the conventions that Nichelle was on, and they struck up a friendship. And that's when she, you know, realized that, you know, the show, the character she portrayed on TV and the show Star Trek, what it portrayed on TV, wasn't really the reality of what the space program was at the time. And ironically, as you would have it, as a perfect storm, if you will, NASA was in the process of, they were coming off the Apollo program, as you know, and they were getting into this new program called the Space Shuttle. And they needed a different kind of astronaut for the Space Shuttle program. They needed a mission specialist as opposed to just pilots. So they were in, and they were in a bit of trouble because the program was about to start and they realized they were short on astronauts. They didn't have what they needed. So that's when Jesko approached Nichelle and said, you know, hey, you know, why don't you get involved with this? Why don't you become part of this? And she said, if I do, I want to do it my way. And it needs to be, you know, I want to create this, the Star Trek universe that I portrayed on TV. And that's exactly what happened. It, in a four-month period, she recruited over 8,000 recruits. And they literally became the first African-American, Asian, Latino men and women to fly in space.
And from that pool of 8,000, they picked a few that would actually go on to become astronauts.
Yeah, the first class of astronaut in 1978 was the first diverse class NASA ever had. And a lot of those recruits were Nichelle's.
What got you interested in the story?
The story came to me, actually. It was November 2014. I got a phone call from my producing partner, Tim Franta. And Tim and his friend Dave, they're both involved in NASA in various aspects. And both definitely Star Trek geeks, if you will. I can say that I asked them ahead of time.
Are you a Trekkie as well?
No. I'm a Star Wars guy.
Okay.
But I have to say, when I was, I think I had my first birthday sleepover at my buddy Eric's house. We were like in fourth grade. And we did a movie night out. And I saw my first Star Trek film that sleepover. Was The Wrath of Khan, which to this day is one of my favorite Star Trek films of all time. So I have an appreciation for it. I do love it, of course. Who doesn't? But I have to say, I grew up being a Star Wars guy. I make movies because of Star Wars, so it was that's what got me into the business, so to speak. But yeah, no, I have appreciation for it, absolutely.
And so the story came to you, and you're like, this is something I need people to see. This is something that people should know about.
It just, yeah, you know, as a filmmaker, I am looking for projects all the time that have a certain thing to them, if you will. And, you know, mostly I look for films that in some way, shape, or form, enlighten us, tell us something we didn't know, or teach us something that will make us better people, make the world a better place. And this one just had that written all over it. So from that perspective, it was a no-brainer for me. It was my first documentary. This was my first documentary film. So it was a little intimidating from that perspective. I go into projects, you know, any filmmaker goes into a project with a script, which is your blueprint. And it tells you exactly, you know, what you need per scene, and how, and you have to decide how you're going to shoot it. With a documentary, you go in and all you really know is, you know, who you're going to be talking to and what questions you think you want to ask them. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, those questions you hope are the right ones, number one. Number two, they most of the time lead to more questions with somebody new you didn't realize existed at the time. So it's like documentaries, or you walk into one room and you find out there's another door, you got to go through another door, and that door leads to another door, and you're just constantly asking questions. And then while you're in those rooms, you figure out, you know, what sort of B-roll you need to shoot to fill your scene with coverage. And so it's a lot of it's like throwing darts at a wall and hoping you get some points, you know, in a lot of ways, just, you know, making a documentary.
But you had that list of people that you knew had to be in the movie from the get-go.
Yeah, you know, there's some docs that are, you know, you're going out there and you're treading new ground, and you're discovering things that, you know, maybe nobody knows about yet. So you never know what's around the next corner. With a historical doc like this, you have a pretty good idea of, you know, who the players are and what the story is, of course, going into it. But there's always surprises, which makes it fun. But at the same time, you know, makes it intimidating because sometimes it doesn't seem like there's an end to it, even though there is. But for us, it was a 4-year journey. I mean, that call came to me in November 2014, and here we are, you know, April 2019, getting ready to show audiences for the first time, giving them a first look at the film.
Did you realize it was going to take this long?
Oh, boy. Definitely not. Mm. No, and to be very honest with you, we had the Star Trek 50th anniversary as a target date for, you know, getting this film done by then. We thought it would be a great time to introduce this story and obviously, you know, tag on to the Star Trek 50th celebration. In retrospect, I'm super glad it didn't work out that way. And it didn't work out that way for a couple different reasons. But this is a film that, you know, deserves its own place. Nichelle deserves her own story. She doesn't need to be, you know, worked into the Star Trek propaganda and the marketing of a 50th anniversary. It's a film that really stands on its own. It's a story that stands on its own, and she deserves that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm talking to director Todd Thompson about the movie Woman in Motion. So, Todd, what was the easiest interview to get? Were there some ones you knew you needed, but you just it took you a while to track them down or figure them out?
Yeah, I mean, Nichelle's was the easiest because the story's about her. So she was our first phone call. And when we started, like I said, we started the project November 14. We had her on board by February of 15. And, you know, the next big question mark was financing. So it took us a while to get some funding together to get on the road.
So tell me more about that first interview you did with Nichelle. And just kind of back to that initial question about opening up doors, more questions you realize you need to ask, kind of different directions you knew you can take the story in. Like, how much of a revelation was it talking to her?
Well, our first trip to Nichelle was it wasn't until October of 15. That's how long it took to get all that together. And we spent about 4 or 5 days at her house. She lives in Los Angeles still. And so that was our first trip to L.A. We did our first round of interviews. We probably interviewed about 4 or 5 people for the story, her being one of them. And we spent, obviously, the bulk of time with her. And we literally just went through her entire life from top to bottom. And obviously, the main focus was her work with NASA. But it was just, to be in her presence and to get to know her and to spend time with her on that level was just extremely humbling. I mean, the woman is just extremely sharp. She's extremely eloquent. She's like being in the presence of a queen, to be quite honest. I mean, she's Hollywood royalty as far as I'm concerned, and she just is the nicest person in the world. And it was just getting to know her and getting to know her story. If I didn't walk in as a Star Trek fan, I left as one because she just exemplifies everything that her character was about and who she is as a person.
Reflecting on her push to recruit future astronauts, how does she feel about that now?
She's extremely emotional about it. I mean, you know, when you see the film, there's a moment where she just takes a step back and, you know, when she sees that first class of astronauts come on TV and get announced to the world, I think it hit her that, you know, I had something to do with that. And she takes it very personally. She's very proud of it. And it's really, at the end of the day, it's a testament to anybody to reassure anyone that, you know, one person can make a difference. Mm-hmm. No matter who you are, no matter how big, no matter how small. I mean, one person can make a huge difference in the world. And that's really what I walked away with.
April 12th has some significance for Space Exploration 2. So why is that a fitting date to be launching this movie?
Yeah, it's extremely ironic. So April 12th is the opening night for the Florida Film Festival. It also happens to be a celebration of Yuri's Night, the first spacewalk, if you will. Mm-hmm. And also, ironically, the celebration of the very first space shuttle launch on April 12th. So it just happened to be that same night, which is great. So we're going to have some astronauts in the audience that, you know, from our cast the night of the opening, and it'll just be a great way to just celebrate all that.
We're kind of in a golden age for documentaries now, right? I mean, in fact, for lots of forms of media, whether it's feature films, television series, and this is your first documentary. Is this a good time to be getting your feet wet in the world of documentary film?
I sure hope so. No, I mean, we're extremely optimistic and excited about it. It ironically, it worked out to be a great time for a film like this. But I found myself, I mean, I'm a movie lover, obviously, and I try to go to the movies as much as I can. And I find myself, even at home, just like the movies that draw me in are documentaries. And I don't even know when that started, but it's been in the past few years. And I don't know if that's just because the choices out there coming out of Hollywood are a little more limited and maybe a little too much of the same thing all the time. There's certainly great films being made out there, but and I want some of my films to be some of them, of course. But yeah, documentaries are just a thing right now, and I love it. I mean, it's hard pressed to find a doc you don't love in some way, shape, or form, no matter what the story's about and who it's about. A doc that's well made just really sucks you in and keeps you engaged. And I saw Won't You Be My Neighbor like four times in the theaters this past year. I was really bummed it didn't get nominated for an Oscar. I was shocked, actually. But I just love that film. I mean, something about that film just resonated with me, and I watched it over and over again. I studied it. I loved everything about it. And it's a great time for docs, that's for sure.
What do you want people to take away from this film?
I want them to be inspired. I want them to look at the space program a different way, look at mankind a different way. I mean, we are all just equal people in this world. I mean, nobody's better than anybody else, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. And this film is, you know, we interviewed everyone from, you know, Hollywood actors to politicians to astronauts, NASA admin on this film. I mean, everyone was interviewed in this film, and they're all just people. And they've all, in their own right, have done amazing things on their own. And for somebody to watch this film, I want them to walk away with knowing, you know, that could be me. I can do that too. And I'm not talking about, you know, people leaving the theater and wanting to get into the space program. I'm talking about people just going out there and wanting to do great things for the world in their own way.
Do you like the new Star Wars movies that have come out in the last few years?
Yeah, I'm a diehard Star Wars fan. In fact, yeah. So I did as much as I could to make this a Star Wars film, and we did our mix at Skywalker Ranch, which was George Lucas's place out there in Marin County, and it was just a great experience out there. And literally, you know, working with people that directly worked on those films. I mean, in fact, there's a sound designer out there named Benny Burt, and his dad Benjamin Burt did all the original sound design and sound effects for the original Star Wars film. So that's really why Skywalker sound exists, because of his father. And Benny recorded the NASA rocket launches for us.
Oh, wow.
So it's the first time that the rocket launches will ever be heard and seen, you know, to picture in a film. So we were really, really lucky to, you know, connect with him and have an opportunity to include those sound effects in the film. And it takes the film to the next level. Like to me, when I got into this, again, being my first doc, I told my partners, my producing partners, you know, we're making a doc, but I don't want the audience to feel like they're watching a doc. I want them to just get sucked into this story and just be entertained for hour and a half, however long it is, ends up being. And I think we accomplished that. I mean, and a lot of it had to do with not just the story and the elements that the components that made up the story, but, you know, the sound design, the music. It all just really kind of sweeps you away, and I think it really came together nicely.
So mixing it out there gave it a kind of a special something that you can't quite put your finger on.
I gave it that Star Wars thing, you know? Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, it just really it took it to the next level. I mean, just everything about working with those guys out there, they're just perfectionists, and it was just cool being out there and collaborating with them on every little frame.
Well, Todd Thompson is the director of Women in Motion, the story of Nichelle Nichols, who was Uhura in the original Star Trek series, and her efforts to recruit minorities and women to the space shuttle program. The film screens this Friday, April 12th, at the Enzian. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to some of the music from the soundtrack to Women in Motion. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to help bring you the conversations and reporting you hear on Intersection. So if you appreciate in-depth local programming, whether it's deep dive political analysis, investigative reporting, or conversations with Central Florida filmmakers, artists, authors, and musicians, then support our Spring Silent Drive. Renew your annual contribution, make an additional gift of support, or take that first step and become a sustaining member. Call 1-800-785-2020 or visit WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.